Okay.
Representative Taylor here. I don't see Representative Taylor.
He was here.
Came up.
She might be just outside.
There you go. I'll let Rod get set.
I'm going to look outside real quick, see if it's here. Just let it go.
Welcome, everybody, to the May 18th, 2015 meeting of the Senate Committee on Business and Transportation. Got a number of bills up today. We're going to start off with House Bill 2375A. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2375A requires state contracting agency to use solicitation template and contract form developed by the Attorney General and the Department of Administrative Services as a basis for all public procurements and contracts. Allows exemption for unique procurements if agency receives approval from the Attorney General or DAS. Requires person conducting procurements for state agency to contemplate training or have professional experience. Requires DAS to establish training and experience requirements. Directs Secretary of State and State Treasurer to develop and use own forms and templates and establish training and experience stands for own staff conducting procurements or administering public contracts. Requires DAS to develop recommendations for promoting best practices and to report to Legislative Assembly by November 30th, 2015, becomes operative January 1st, 2016, declares emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and there is a fiscal impact issued.
All righty. Representatives Taylor and Nathanson.
Two of my favorite troublemakers from the other side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. Oregon taxpayers expect accountability and efficiency in how public funds are used, and they have sent us here in order to ensure that their money is used wisely and in the most effective way possible. When it comes to how public funds are spent on contracts, meeting that obligation requires accountability and oversight. This bill moves us toward that goal. As legislators, we get briefings about projects that have gone awry, and some of those biggest botched projects that have landed on the front page of the newspaper are still in our memory. By the time these project failures have come to light, it's already too late. We need to improve our track record on contracts by starting off on the right foot, by having solid contract language in place to protect the public interest, and we need to do a better job of managing contracts. As a bit of background, the legislature passed new contract accountability measures last year in 2014, specifically targeting information technology. This bill continues that work, but it's no longer specifically and only about IT. This bill is about all contracts. Over the past half year, I've met on a number of occasions with representatives of state agencies, with experts in purchasing, contract law, and auditing. They have provided some good information and perspective on what has happened in the past and what's possible and best to improve our prospects for the future. This bill puts in place a process to add safeguards and measures to increase accountability, standardization, and oversight. This bill addresses those two objectives, raising the bar for both drafting contracts and then for managing them once they're in place. Two major elements of the bill. It adds an element of uniformity in contract language that currently doesn't exist, and it requires training for people administering the contracts to ensure that they're adequately prepared to manage expensive and significant projects. So the distinct elements to the proposal are, number one, better contracts. Dozens of agencies design and write their own contracts with varying skill and style and content. In fact, there are over 400 different forms that people are using, and last year DOJ reviewed over 3,000 contracts written from different forms or templates. This bill will require agencies to start with standard language approved by experts in purchasing and in the law. And I'd like to emphasize to start with standard language. Nothing in this bill disallows flexibility that will be appropriate. This bill requires state agencies to use standard forms and templates approved by Department of Administrative Services or Department of Justice. Over time, we will have better contracts, and it should save time and money for departments that are processing contracts. It will likely also help Oregon businesses. For vendors, it is hard to respond to procurements, requests for proposals, or bids because the requirements are different from agency to agency. It's a steep learning curve, I have learned, to wade through all of that fine print. And even in sections that are labeled as standard boilerplate state language, it's organized differently and comes in different words from one agency to another. With this bill bringing standardization to the process, it will be easier for Oregon businesses, and indeed all businesses, to deal with Oregon and to bid on state contracts. The second part is about better contract administration. It requires training for contract administrators. There are many state employees who end up managing contracts, but it's only a very small part of their job. Mostly, they're managing a program for an agency, but they also have a contract to manage. This bill will make sure that they have the training and resources to appropriately manage the contracts to be sure that the product or the service is living up to expectations. There are a couple other features the agency needs to sign off, and it instructs DAS to develop some best practices and to consider whether a system of peer review would bring some additional good practice to the state. I'd like to respond to some issues that have come up very recently. There's a concern that this bill interferes with agency negotiations. Agencies negotiate with contractors, generally, and specifically, sometimes they're negotiating with regard to the topic of risk. This bill is not intended to change current practice, and I have conferred that this bill should not change current practice. Department of Justice tells me, quote, "To the extent the procurement code and model rules permit negotiations by the parties of contract terms and conditions, including risk, insurance, and insurance, this legislation does not change the procurement code or require changes to the model rules regarding such negotiation," end quote. Another concern is that the bill removes flexibility and requires a single standard template and form. That is just not the case. I am assured by DAS and by DOJ that the bill does allow plenty of flexibility, and in fact, ODOT has standard forms and templates that have been approved. There are already different templates and forms tailored for specific purposes. For example, ODOT templates for highway construction and other templates for architect, engineering, and related services. DHS templates for professional services, medical services, and client services. DAS templates for information technology, construction, standard trade goods and services, professional services, and statewide price agreements. This bill does not take away the flexibility. In fact, the way the bill is written, it's designed to acknowledge that there should be different forms and templates for different kinds of products or services. And some of the lines in the bill that recognize the need for different forms and templates, I'm not going to read them all to you, but on page 3, lines 18 through 21, for example, the bill clearly calls for collaboration between DAS and DOJ. I am confident that the concerns in letters that I have seen will be addressed as the bill is implemented. There was a concern that Oregon is moving to give the state CIO more authority and oversight, and this bill would reverse that. That also is simply not the case. I have confirmed with both DAS and Department of Justice that that is not what this bill would do. There's another concern that Oregon is moving in the direction of rigid procurement processes and procedures. Well, I do admit, yes, we are trying to get some standardization, to make it easier for business to respond to contracts, to make it easier for us to write good contracts in the public interest, and for contracts that we can better enforce. We are indeed moving toward adopting standards, which have been lacking in Oregon. The state contracted with a consultant in 2013 to review Oregon's procurement processes and compare us to five peer states and two public jurisdictions in Oregon. One of the top recommendations of the consultant was, quote, use standard contract templates. In our industry, which is public, the public's business, government agencies working on behalf of the public, this is an industry standard and best practice. And other states are already ahead of us in this move toward establishing statewide best practices. And moreover, in 2010, I have a copy of a letter from Tech America where they wrote a letter to Governor Kulongoski commending Oregon for its comprehensive overhaul of IT terms and conditions. Quote, this will go a long way to streamlining procurement, which at the end of the day is good for the state and good for its taxpayers. There are two key ways for the legislature and the public to get better oversight and better results. Better contracts and better contract management and administration. Thank you for hearing this bill.
Please.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. I'm Kathleen Taylor, House District 41, South parts of Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on House Bill 2375, which establishes some standard solicitation and contract templates for all public procurements and contracts, and also requires employees charged with procurements to receive training or have professional experience in making these agreements. One of the areas for improved efficiency recommended by a recent Department of Administrative Services review was the state of Oregon to develop standardized forms and contracts for state agency procurements while providing flexibility to meet new contract needs. The Department of Justice found the state agencies were using over 400 different forms and a multitude of employees managing them. DAS and DOJ are, as my understanding, are in total support of this bill. We are talking about millions and millions of dollars in state contracts. Because of the wide variety of contracting procedures, we have little contract accountability. Quality varies from agency to agency. Oversight of contracts vary from agency to agency as well. Then if some contract goes bad and the problem hits the headlines, the people responsible for managing the contracts have often not had the training and experience to manage the situation. As a former management auditor, I want to emphasize the importance of employee training and support in entering into and management of state contracts. For too long, state agencies are caught playing catch-up, negotiating with business professionals. House Bill 2375 will go a long way to improve contracting accountability in state government. Chair Byer, I just also wanted to add, this is a very, very important bill. And funny enough, after I won the election in the primary and in the general, this was something that I was going to bring forward myself, this very issue. And I can tell you from working as a management auditor at the city, county, metro, and state level, it is very, very important that we take this issue seriously. It needs to be standardized. We need to train our employees, and we need to empower them to understand what they're entering into with these agreements, because this is where so much of the state's money is being spent, are in these contracts. And I really want to commend Representative Nathanson for taking on this very issue, very big issue. And frankly, she just beat me to the punch. So I'm glad to be here testifying with her.
So representatives, whoever wants to pitch this one, as I read this, you're talking about kind of the standard contract language, but not about that which details what the project is or the price of the project. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
So these are just the boilerplate that usually becomes the attachment to the contract, kind of standard language. Can that be? It seems like there's a provision that, with the Attorney General's approval, that could be altered?
Mr. Chair, yes, forms and templates can be developed to meet specific purposes, and those would be reviewed by either DAS or DOJ. And then the specific contracts themselves will, of course, from time to time need to depart from a standard type contract because there's something a little unique about that situation, either the place where something is taking place, the location, or maybe it's the product is a little different, or the service is a little different. Sometimes we're buying something over and over again that really is substantially the same. Often, though, we are buying something that's a little different, and the contract will reflect that. And I would also like to make sure that we have representatives from Department of Administrative Services and Department of Justice here able to answer those questions for you.
They're here. I can see them. It seems like, Representative, that we addressed this, I don't remember, a number of years ago. We were looking at a lot of the Human Services Department where every contract was getting delayed because they had to have AG's approval, and the resolution to that was develop a standard contract that didn't have to have AG approval.
Mr. Chair, there are still circumstances under which contracts over a certain amount, dollar amount, have to have approval. In my opinion, part of the problem with the time it takes to review contracts is that we're sending a lot of stuff through that's written in a non-standard way. I heard from one person that you can have two people working in the same department, in fact, the same work unit, sending contracts to do virtually the same thing but using different language. This is not an efficient use, and it also means Department of Justice has to review entirely new language each time rather than language that's going to conform to something that, whether it's three or four people writing those contracts, they're all starting from the same page and basically just fill in the blank.
Other questions?
Yeah, I got a couple.
Senator
Dry. Yeah, the first one, I'm looking for the flexibility of an opt-out, because anytime you use the word require, it kind of worries me a little bit. So where in this bill is the flexibility to opt out that you have a one-of-a-kind sort of contract you got to write? So I can just actually see what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, it's not opting out. It's that you can write something different that needs to be included. I'm going to look for what. I believe it's page 3, lines 18 through 21, and then page 2, lines 37 through 45. Let me look at that. Page 2. I hope this is the same on the A engrossed.
Oh, page 2, what were the lines?
Right here.
37 through 45, and then it continues on to the next page, lines 1 to 2. Yes, that's correct. So, let's see.
Well,
37 through 45. And then below that, it talks about if the state agency is, let's see. Oh, B, the nature of the procurement is unique, and public contract requires specific terms and conditions to accommodate the unique nature of the procurement or the state contracting agency in accordance with provisions, et cetera, that differ from the terms and conditions in a contract form or contract template. So that's one of the main sections where that flexibility is enabled.
Let me read through this, but it seems to me like if you want an exception, then you're going to have to go through a lot of red tape to get the exception. Am I misreading that? Or
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, agencies already have to get DOJ approval for contracts. And this is actually intended to speed things up. If they're starting out with at least the basic stuff is in standard language, then it will be easier and quicker to review just the parts that need to be different because they are unique.
Okay. The second one is another requirement of the director or head of state to sign a statement that acknowledges that the director or head of state contracting agency reviewed and verified that the person that will administer the contract read and understood legal advice and recommendation from the Oregon Department of Administrative Services. That's another requirement. So you want to explain that part of it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, I'd be happy to. There are instances, I am told, where Department of Justice has provided advice to an agency that a contract would be better to protect the public interest if it included certain language or if a section was written in a different way, and agencies decline to take that advice, thereby putting the state and the public money at increased risk. And so this is meant to say that the state employees, the director or the manager, have read that advice and for some reason have decided that their interpretation of the level of risk they're willing to assume is preferable than the advice that DOJ provided. And I'm going to ask if my colleague, Representative Taylor, has any other comments to add.
Somewhat related, but I think it's important to, in the training part of this, it's an important piece of the bill because ideally in agencies we'll start to have employees, they'll receive more thorough training and they will learn how to ask the appropriate questions, make certain that in the template, you know, what's the payment process going to be? So are you going to making certain that we're not paying people for work not completed? I mean, there's a lot of things that go on in agencies that are really not in the public's best interest, and we want to make certain that they're, when they fill out the standard form, that they've thought about all the things that should be in the contract, what the conditions are, and when they do that, when it gets handed over to the Department of Justice, then the Department of Justice has some assurance that that employee or the manager or director, all the different levels, have gone through, hopefully with some rigor, and answered some of these questions with whoever it is that they're entering the contract in with. So it's going to put, it's not, I really would not, with all due respect, I would not look at this as creating more red tape. I would look at this as eliminating red tape because it's going to streamline the process. And we need to make certain that these questions are answered in the standard form. Now, if it is more complicated, if it happens to be forestry practices or something in the Department of Transportation, there's something unique with it, then what will happen is that there'll be an addendum of a type, and it will go into something more specific. And that will happen. I mean, and that should happen. There should be additional specific language depending on the nature of the contract. So that's how I see it. So.
Oh, I think so.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is one of the issues that I've been concerned about for a long time, and I believe this is really important. Every agency in every contract thinks it's a unique situation, believe me. And if we don't do this standardization, we're going to continue to have the situations that we've had in the past. It's my opinion that in all the highly publicized failures that the state has had, a large factor in that is bad contracts. And I think this goes a long way to solve that problem. Maybe not quite all the way, but it goes a long way, and it's a good step forward. I don't have a question, just this comment. I think this is a very good bill. Thank you.
All righty. Anything else? Thank you very much, representatives. I see Representative Buckley's in the audience, so I'm going to recess on this one, and we'll get back to it. I will open on House Bill 2594A.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2594A requires insurer of liable party to pay actual costs of emergency response provided by private emergency responders. There are no amendments, there is no revenue impact, and no fiscal impact.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the Oregon House. This bill was brought forward on behalf of a constituent who runs a hazmat cleanup company. Yeah, he does a variety of different jobs, but on the hazmat projects that he's been part of, his frustration is that oftentimes he'll get paid the same as a tow truck driver or another service operator, even though his operations are more expensive, the training required is much more intense. So what the bill just does, it simply says that the emergency responder has to be paid for their services, for the services they provide. It passed unanimously out of the House Labor Committee, and I appreciate you taking the time and consideration of the bill.
So is there some way that you assure what the fees are? I mean, is there some standard for that, or is it just whatever they choose to bill?
Members of the committee, they have to obviously list what their costs were incurred in the performance of their duties.
Senator Duran.
What happens if there's a private contract with a private contractor? I mean, are we in a, I mean, it's so that the insurance company has a contract with the contractor that's there, is this going to interfere with that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, I don't believe this would. I'm trying to usually the cases, at least described to me by my constituent, was they're on call for a situation that they're not. It's the situation you're referring to has not been described as something that's common, at least in my constituents' experience.
Go ahead.
The way it is now, it looks like the insurance company has the hammer, and what you're trying to do is give the hammer to the cleanup company.
Mr. Chair, Senator, actually, what we're just trying to do is have the compensation be for the costs incurred. And the insurance companies that weighed in on the House side had initial concerns. They seemed comfortable with it, hence the unanimous vote out of the House committee.
Senator Riley.
Thank you. So this is not a bill that is unitemized. This is about actual expenses, and they have to be itemized and explained. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, that's correct. They have to be able to document what their expenses were in doing the cleanup, and then be compensated for those expenses they incurred.
Thank you.
What if there's a disagreement over what the actual expenses were?
Mr. Chair, I think that you would probably have more expertise than I do in terms of what happens when there's a business dispute between a contractor and insurer.
Not really.
I would assume that your committee hears those sort of concerns on a regular basis.
It's called courts.
Other questions? I think we better take a look at this, you think?
It deals with contracts.
Mr. Chair, if you would like to, I'd be happy to arrange for my constituent to call any members of the committee to talk about his experiences and why he felt it's necessary to bring this bill forward.
Representative, the only concern I have, and maybe others don't have it, I don't have any concern with the concept at all. I just kind of trying to figure out who decides or how do you decide what is a legitimate cost or not. I mean, materials and equipment, those kinds of things are reasonable, but just trying to, if there's a dispute between the two parties about, you know, and he says, you know, I should be paid $1,000 an hour to
right.
do this. It's kind of like, okay, are we saying, well, if that's what you think you ought to be paid, that's what you'll be paid.
Mr. Chair, my apologies, my knowledge of this industry is not vast. I would assume that there are standard rates for standard services, but I'll get that information for you.
Okay. That'd be helpful, just dealing with that. I think you're on track here. It's just I worry about that.
Understandable.
Okay. Others? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr.
I would appreciate it if we can do that, if we can hold it over a day and see.
Sounds good.
I appreciate that. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify this while I got it under? I don't have any other. If not, we will close on that. And do I have another one in the audience yet?
We do not.
We do not. So we can go back to, we'll reconvene or reopen on House Bill 2375. And If we can get Diane Lancaster and Mark Williams at the same time. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Nothing like a little contract law, huh? These are the experts.
For the record, I'm Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services.
And Chair Beyer, I'm Mark Williams from the Department of Justice. I'm the attorney in charge of the business transactions section.
Okay. Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I think Representatives Nathanson and Taylor said it very well. This bill is one that provides a new direction and supports work, frankly, that the legislature has laid down over time, facilitates consistent use of best practice. I am very interested in the help for Oregon business. I think Oregon business has long said that one of the issues for them are the inconsistent forms and templates and things that agencies use, and so we're happy for that idea. The issue of flexibility is an important one, and we recognize that. I think if you do look at the bottom of page 2, you'll note that that section on lines 43 through 45 notes that the agency can use other terms and conditions other than the standard ones that are in the contract form. It says only if, but if you go down to sub B at line 43, the nature of the procurement is unique. Certainly there are those. Or the state agency, in accordance with provisions in the solicitation documents, lets the public know that there will be room for negotiation of terms and conditions that differ from those in the form. So there are some pretty specific words that we have tried to help put in here that we will, of course, work with the Department of Justice to make real for those situations that require flexibility. Probably the most important role, or one of the most important roles for the Department of Administrative Services, is to help build a structure, standards, and actual engagement of training opportunities for people who must do contract management. This is a topic which, in my work, we are discussing across the country, because many states have had issues with contract management and the results that you may or may not get with solid, knowledgeable contract management. And that's why both representatives commented that we want people who understand the boilerplate. We often just kind of wave it away, but there's importance there. And we want to have program people really prepared to manage a contract for success. I'm happy to answer any further questions that you might have.
I'm familiar with that. I think all but the simple, smallest contracts that are using the standardized form have to be approved by DOJ. Is that correct?
Contracts over $150,000.
How much?
$150,000 is the threshold.
Okay. And do those all have to be reviewed by DAS as well?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, no. Department of Administrative Services, by its own rules, has delegated a number of areas of contracting. One of those significant areas is architectural and engineering services. We actually do none of that contracting, because there are the agencies who do construct public improvements generally have the in-house, they have the best expertise, and they are the ones who are working with the public architectural and engineering firms. So that is one significant area. Also, agencies have received by legislative action a number of grants of statutory authority. For example, ODOT has a grant of authority to run the highways and all transportation systems, and of course that includes all the contracting documents that go with it. So yes, there are a number of different types of delegations.
How about IT?
Information technology, of course, is a hot topic. In information technology, DAS has delegated all IT acquisitions under the $150,000 level, which is the formal threshold set by this body. Now, for anything over $150,000, an agency may have legislative authority, but as you know, even some of that is being pulled back, Senate Bill 7 being an example. We do not know the ultimate fate right now of House Bill 3099, which is a key key piece around the CIO's authority and the office of the CIO. So we'll see how the ground shifts as we go forward. I think many of us are looking forward to a knowledgeable place. DAS certainly has knowledgeable buyers and people in information technology, but of course I think everyone's looking to that office as a new.
I think Senator Riley will have some concerns about that. I know from my participation on the interim work group dealing with Cover Oregon that the strong feeling come out of the legislators at that point was that any significant IT project should be the contract and everything else should be under the chief information officer. Senator Riley?
Thank you. And House Bill 3099 would, in fact, not take that that contracting ability under the CIO, but would give the CIO authority to review all IT contracts and approve all IT contracts. So as it stands right now, that's what Senate Bill 3099 would do, and I believe that that's how it's going to end up.
And Senator Beyer, Senator Riley, thank you. And yes, the actual process will probably continue to be done by state procurement buyers at DAS, but obviously the Chief Information Officer's office will be setting standards and review standards.
Go ahead, Senator.
Yeah, I'm more interested in the specifics of this bill. I understand the overlying principle, and I actually agree with it. But the way the bill reads, a state contracting, I'm reading from on page 2, line 37 and 38, a state contracting agency may base a public contract on terms and conditions other than the terms and conditions set forth in the contract form or contract template only if, and then they give the only ifs.
Right.
Okay. That seems like it's just kind of wired down pretty tight, and that kind of bothers me a little bit. I agree that it's one of those you want to hit the sweet spot, and I'm thinking a state of emergency. There should be opt-outs that are not in this bill because if we have a big earthquake and someone says, you know, to do this bridge, or I'm just trying to think outside the box, you know, that they don't want to have to contact either DAS or, and so that's what I'm worried about.
Why don't I ask Mark Williams to answer that?
Chair Beyer, Senator Gerard, if you look at page 3, line 9 and 10, emergency procurements 279B-065 are excluded from this requirement.
Does not apply.
That's the emergency procurement legislation.
9 and 10?
Yes, on page 3.
So that you're referring to the reference to ORS 279B?
065, you're right.
Okay,
that's emergency procurement, yes.
Okay, hey, thanks.
Other questions?
No.
How do you, Diane, how do you react to the concern that some, I think, have raised in letters to us, that mostly, I can't remember, the IT community, about it may ratchet down the things too tightly to drive off some of the potential good bidders?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I think Senator Gerard has actually hit that point, that notion of a sweet spot. Currently, we are using, and again, none of this is absolutely new, because we have been, as Representative Nathanson pointed out, we have been using some standards for some years. In 2008, we created the first set of information technology standard terms and conditions, and we engaged the trade associations at that time. I don't know that this one was in existence at that time, but we did engage high-tech industry representatives to work with us and to give us comment. For the last year and a half, we have brought that group back together, Mark Williams folks, DAS folks, and chief information officers from around the state agencies, and again invited those trade associations to join us. We just completed a revision document updating the 2008 work, and we are just about into the cloud. We have new pieces. It's amazing. Information technology just keeps changing. So we have some new work on how to contract for cloud services and other modern services that we're now looking to complete by the end of June. So the collaboration is critical. You have to have you know, you have to have the engagement of the industry with which you are ultimately going to contract.
You know, our track record isn't exactly stellar. You know, when Alex Pettit was hired, you know, I jokingly told him when he was appearing his first time in front of our IT committee, then I said, you know, the joke around here is when a department manager gets an IT project approved by the legislature, we tell them, says, congratulations, you got your project approved. Have you started working on your resume?
Senator. Mr. Chair, one of the things that you'll see is that in the very large failures that we've had, the legislature has granted those agencies the ability to skip this procedure, to write their own contracts and not look at the standard contracts. This happened in a couple of different cases that you might be aware of, and it's about to happen in another one that we need to stop. So I think that, you know, granting agencies the ability, which we do in this body, to ignore that that process causes more problems than having them go through the process.
Good point. Other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And now I have Carol Hinton. Hinton? And actually, Megan Schrader, are you here as well? All right. Go ahead.
Okay.
Please.
My name is Carol Hinton. I'm with the IT Alliance for Public Sector, and I'm very pleased to be here today. I've been a person involved with state procurement policy for the better part of 15 years, and in fact, as Ms. Lancaster just alluded, I've been involved even in much of what Oregon has been setting out to do in the 2007-2008 timeframe. My organization is a Washington, D.C.-based trade association representing a lot of the leading vendors. In particular, our group, which we call ITAPS, IT Alliance for Public Sector, is all focused on state, local, and federal contracting and IT acquisition. The reason I'm here today is to express concerns about this bill. There's some very laudable things contained in this bill, particularly the training element, and we're not here to suggest that there shouldn't be some standardization in approach to contracting. I think, you know, I've heard that around the table here today. We agree, and which is why we have worked not only in Oregon, California, and other states to help shape a standard template for contracting. Our concern is that this bill, by putting it into statute, that the contract template that has been developed by DAS and DOJ must be used by all agencies and departments without alterations. And I think that's, you know, those two words are probably the most problematic in our estimation in the bill. It is concerning to us. We just think that this will lead to more inflexibility. I recognize that there are some exemptions. The exemption for $150,000, that's fine. Most projects that I'm talking about, that our companies are concerned about, are of a size larger than that. There is a provision for a special procurement, but even so, you're going to have a situation where there'll be more delays while each in one of these contracts has to be individually dealt with by Department of Justice here in Oregon. So delays are one thing, but there's, to your point, Senator Riley, there's a premise that if we put very high risk protections around a RFP, that's a good thing. But I will tell you that I work all around the country, and in many cases, the leading companies simply will not bid. And if they do bid, they will do it indirectly, which was the case with one of your more recent troubled projects. It did not go directly to the vendor that you were contracting for the services. In the case of the state of Maryland, now I know the Health Insurance Exchange was a rush situation. We had to implement it quite quickly. It wasn't exactly an emergency dealing with a bridge falling down, but it was important to move it quickly. State of Maryland contracted with two small companies. One of them went bankrupt during the course of the process. So leading companies stayed away from that important IT project. So what we are concerned about with the way the bill is written today is that there's a certain amount of inflexibility, which is what you spoke about, that is built into this bill, that we would like to see there be a way to shape that so that the final bill, the outcome of this, is just not going to tie the hands of Oregon. I personally do believe, and the companies I represent feel like Oregon will regret that it locked itself into this in statute. It seems to be that this should be something that would be handled by the administrative executive branch of government and not necessarily codified into a bill or into a law.
It seems like there's a lot of flexibility here. I hear your concern, but I'm just reading the terms. Is contracting agency may vary the terms and conditions set forth in the contract template with the advice of the Attorney General. And that seems like it's there, and there's further down it talks about if the determines that the contract crisis, well,
you've heard from officials today that there are 400 different departments and agencies using different approaches. There were 3,000 IT contracts this past year. If you have to slow it down each and every single time, that's going to lead to some further.
But aren't what you're really into, I mean, if you're going to bid and I recognize on a job, what you're really into are not the standardized terms and conditions. What you're into is the scope of work.
Right.
And
statement of work.
And it doesn't apply to price.
No.
In this. So, I mean, the scope of work is going to be different on every contract by definition.
Exactly. Exactly. Particularly the major ones that are unique, whether they're in the area of health and human services or employment development or whatever the state is engaging in. So the bottom line is that we suggest that there be an opportunity to consider some amendments or, you know, the parts of the bill about the rigid approach to contracting with a contract template. Because even though industry had an opportunity to comment on the template that Oregon most recently considered, at the end of the day, we didn't agree that it was a good template. It had some high stakes in it for high-risk protections that were considered to be in the best interest of the state of Oregon by Department of Justice officials, but that doesn't mean to say that it was at all representative of something that a lot of leading companies would want to or would be even able to.
Can you give me an example?
Warranty, limitation of liability, indemnification, rights of data, which is your intellectual property protections. Those are the types of things that are the major issue areas of state contracting.
Mm-hmm. And those are the kinds of things that I would think we would probably want to have in a standardized document.
Exactly. I'm just saying to you that the leading companies may not bid directly, and that's where you get into difficult problems with trying to enforce the contracts. And you actually lose margin. It was alluded to by Ms. Lancaster that they are looking at some new innovative approaches to cloud computing. If cloud computing is really going to scale, and it is the way that Oregon and all states, all local governments, federal government's going to save money on IT, it needs to be easily adapted almost to whatever the commercial market terms and conditions are, with considerations about privacy and data security. We all know that cloud computing is an important area for privacy and data security issues, and those are paramount issues. I'm not here to dispel that those are not important issues. I'm only suggesting that contracting needs to be able to be fast and not quite so rigid as to suggest that there be one template and that you have to have a special procurement to go away from it.
Those are different things, fast and flexible.
Right.
Senator Ryland and Senator Girod.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, one of the things that I think we really need to look at here is not how fast we can do contracting. Fast is not what's important. What's important is getting the right contract for the right job. And just because we can do it fast isn't the right, you know, emphasis. What we really want to do, and in my opinion, is to make sure that we get it right and that we do have the protections that are necessary to protect our taxpayers.
Well, Senator Riley, that's a good point. And let me respond by suggesting that sometimes when you are a Department of Energy agency, you're conceiving of a need for an IT project, you're developing your requirements, you're putting together the RFP, you might even be hiring a vendor, an outside consulting company to help you shape the terms of the RFP, then you put the RFP on the street, then you give some time for the vendors to all respond, and then you have your time for evaluation. These things stretch out easily to 18 months, and the
yes.
problem with that, and sometimes even longer, and states like my state of California. The problem is sometimes you're going to then end up acquiring something that has that doesn't meet, that isn't the latest state-of-the-art solution because you've kind of taken so long to get to that point. So there is a problem when it takes a long time to procure.
And at the same time, Mr. Chair, if I may, If we had done that contract quickly and got these things in place, 18 months, we would be out of date anyway.
All righty. Senator Girard?
Yeah, I've done a few contracts in my day, and I find it to be a really give-and-take process.
Yes.
And what bothers me with this bill is everything falls on the lap of the AG or DAS, and they might not have the knowledge to do the negotiation into the detail that which you're talking, and that's why I said I was really concerned about the flexibility. Is that kind of the summation of your concern?
Yes. In fact, it occurs to me that maybe one way to resolve this is to look at the possibility of putting in a provision much like California's done, and I know other states don't like to hear about the way we do it in California, and trust me, California has no lock on successful IT projects, not at all. However, they do have, since 2003, a provision in statute. It's known as Section 6611, which is where it can be found in the public contract code, which allows for flexibility in bidding. So when the bids are opened, the sealed envelopes are presented, they can meet with vendor, the vendor that they select as number one, and they take sort of like 7 days. And if they can't get to agreement with that vendor, then they go to the next vendor. And they negotiate post-bid, and there's a lot of flexibility in that. So now all major procurements in California are under the auspices of the so-called Section 6611. And that may be a way to do this.
I think we have that now under contract law. You can do that in Oregon now.
Yeah, our DOJ person is nodding that's correct.
Good.
Other, Senator Gerard, any more?
No, it brings up the same concern that I was voicing, so yeah.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank
Most
you.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
You for the opportunity.
Megan Schrader?
Specifying another hearing right now.
All right, we'll move on down. Skip Newberry?
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. My name is Skip Newberry, president of the Technology Association of Oregon. We represent about 300 or so technology companies in Oregon, ranging from very small to some of the very largest companies as well. I reside in Northeast Portland, and the Technology Association has offices in both Portland as well as Eugene, Oregon. In terms of testimony today, I just wanted to highlight a few points. I think Carol did a good job of kind of going into detail on some of the concerns that some of our members share with the proposed bill. I think that none of us would argue with the fact that oversight and management and training and improvements along those lines are great goals. I think the issue that we're hearing from companies is mainly with regard to flexibility and sort of an overly rigid type of framework that companies are looking at the proposed bill and having some concerns somewhat. I think the issue is with regard to establishing a contractual relationship, it's the focus on sort of the rigidity at the outset. I think that there's definitely some remedies that can be included over the long haul in terms of managing it effectively and providing training as has been proposed. The main issue that we have here is with regard to IT. And as Carol pointed out, you know, there's a really fast pace of change within technology these days, whether talking about cloud computing or shifts to mobility. And there are a lot of examples of organizations in the public, academic, and private sectors that have been able to take advantage of some of these innovations and changes to help reduce costs and improve efficiencies. And so that's really, I think, the concern here is we want to make sure that there's, no matter what the proposed bill ultimately looks like, that there's a solution that industry feels like at the small on up to the very largest levels that they can live with. And it's not that everyone's going to be 100% happy, but I think there are enough concerns that we're hearing now with the bill as proposed that at the end of the day, we'd love to be able to, you know, have a little bit more time to kind of evaluate and discuss some of the concerns. I'm not going to go into great detail. I think Carol hit upon many of them and want to be respectful of everyone's time that has signed up to testify.
I just want to just clarify for myself. It sounds like, Carol, and your concern, too, is about what the template looks like and the flexibility to use it more than necessarily the statutory language, although I hear it expressed there.
Yeah, I think there's it's not necessarily with the statutory sort of approach that's being taken. I think it's more with the terminology. I think there would be some companies that would say, whoa, you know, even a statutory, approach is something that's just too rigid on its face. But I think there's some variation there. And I think that's a big reason why we want to be able to have some more time to, kind of flush out some additional concerns to make sure that some of the companies that are now coming to the table on this and saying, hey, you know, what's going on here, to make sure that their voices are part of the conversation.
So you're not really going to be a company when a bid becomes, the process is underway. Companies are not going to be looking at the statute. They're going to be looking at the solicitation.
And
I assume they would put out with that, to the extent that there's a standard terms and conditions, that's usually attached to the solicitation so people can see that.
Yeah, so I'm not sure is your question to the companies as a whole have an issue with the statutory issue?
The discussion is around, is there I think the real question where Senator Girard was probing is there really flexibility there? And what I'm hearing from the people who are going to manage the contracts is that they believe there is flexibility there. While we're looking for a standardization, there's the ability within that to modify it if the procuring agency working with DAS and the Attorney General's office feel a need. I think that's right. That's the head nod I'm getting, so...
Yeah, and I think that it's you know, a sliding scale is one way to think of it. And I think the companies are a bit concerned that it shifts too far in what could be viewed as a more rigid or inflexible scale in terms of the issue of speed, which is an important issue based on the speed at which technology is changing, and also smaller companies that may want to be, you know, vying for different pieces of a contract as well. Many of them can't wait necessarily, you know, 2 years, you know, to make a go of it. And so if we're really thinking about some of the issues that came up over previous IT projects and some of the blowback that the state got, I think that was one of them was, you know, are we leveraging the talent and expertise that exists here across a large base of companies? And I think that's one area here that, you know, we want to see a win out of this. I think there's a great opportunity to have something that everyone can live with at the end of the day.
Appreciate that.
Thanks.
Questions? No questions? Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks.
Let's see. Marshall Koba.
Good afternoon, Chair Byron, member of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies. ACEC Oregon has about 110 member firms and 3,500 employees in the state of Oregon. We understand and appreciate the concept of House Bill 2375, and we've shared our concerns with Representative Nathanson and her staff over the last couple of weeks. However, the language twice in House Bill 2375, the language refers to reducing risk for the agencies, and we are concerned about this potential shift of risk to consultants. ACEC Oregon has a standing committee, which is a risk management committee. I've had the pleasure of attending that committee a couple times, and it's a group of professionals that sit around and talk about risk management. And so anytime that this issue is mentioned in a piece of legislation, some ears perk up. In one instance, it's in the contract form on page 2, line 33. It talks about using a contract form or contract template is necessary for the state contracting agency to avoid significant liabilities or other risks. And a second time on page 5, line 18, in the advice and recommendations, is predicated on previous successes and failures and reducing risks and inefficiencies, and it goes on from there. So it's, you know, we're not in the business of trying to reduce all risk to the private sector. That's not the case at all. But we think that there is a thoughtful and reasonable approach to risk assessment in contracting. Our industry may be different than the previous testifiers in that our type of procurement, where the state is protected by the Tort Claims Act and a private industry is not, we may not be. If all the significant risk is shifted to the private industry engineers, we have potentially unlimited liability, and it's not an equal shift. We understand this may be an interpretation issue of the wording related to avoiding risks, and a clarification we believe would help avoid future issues. We would ask that in the section about significant, in that line 2, page 2, line 33, where it talks about significant liabilities or other risks, that appropriate or reasonable be added to give some additional clarification that the intent is to not to shift all risk, but appropriate or reasonable. And talking about the template, we believe we are business partners with the state, and we are. We've worked closely with ODOT, other state agencies working on major projects around the state. And as a partner, we believe it's important to review and provide feedback on the templates prior to use. We would like to see all the agencies operate similar to ODOT, who we work incredibly closely with in providing templates to private industry to provide appropriate and adequate review and comments. And we have provided these comments in the past to ODOT. We appreciate your time today. We look forward to working with Representative Nathanson and the committee to address some of these issues. Thank you.
Appreciate your concerns, Marshall. Other questions? Thank you. Okay, let's see here. Is Megan Schrader here now?
No, sir. She's still in.
Still testifying. All right. Well, that looks like. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2375? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 75, and I think we'll carry that one over. Where do we need to go next?
3501, Representative Hack is here.
Okay. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3501. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3501 revises voting requirements for certain actions related to formation or conversion of benefit company. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Welcome, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jody Hack, and I am the representative for House District 19. And today we're here to talk to you about House Bill 3501. This is a simple bill that would make a small change, but an important change, to the voting requirements for publicly owned benefit companies. Under the current voting conditions, it's very difficult for benefit companies to gather all of their shareholders to pass actions. These small publicly owned companies struggle to achieve a quorum because they are broadly held by numerous small investors, making the two-thirds majority vote requirement nearly impossible. House Bill 3501 would make it so that the shareholder majority vote requirements for benefit companies would change from two-thirds to a simple majority vote. It's a simple bill with an easy fix, and so I urge your support. And today with me is Jim Bruneau, and he can speak to the bill as well.
Welcome, Jim.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Jim Bruneau. I'm the founder and president of Willamette Valley Vineyards, possibly one of America's smallest publicly held companies. I do appreciate very much the legislature's development of the benefit company status that was developed, I think, in the last legislative session. It did allow for corporations by majority vote that were privately held to select this form of organization, but it required publicly held companies to use a two-thirds majority. And for large public companies, that works just fine because their stock is held in very large blocks and have voted in large blocks. But in very small publicly held companies, our shares are very broadly held. And it's difficult to get all of the 5,000 shareholders that Willamette Valley Vineyards has to cast their votes on their shares because many of them hold them in such small amounts. So the... What we're asking is that small publicly held companies be treated in the same manner as the legislature identified privately held companies to be treated in the election of this form of organization.
Okay. Weren't you, wasn't Willamette Valley the initial penny stock in Oregon?
It was the very first crowdfunded business in America.
Oh, you're using new terms. I don't think you called it that back then. Yes,
Senator. Yeah, I always have specific questions. The votes, when you're counting up the votes, is that the votes cast? So you have to reach a 50% of the votes cast?
No.
Or 50% of the stock that's in?
Exactly. Mr. Chair, members, that's the problem. It's two-thirds of the votes. Presently, the law is two-thirds of the votes entitled to vote.
Yeah.
So that's a very, very high standard. It would require, frankly, us to achieve virtually 100% vote in favor of this election, which is very difficult in any organization, as you're familiar.
Okay. So we're asking that you change that from a two-thirds to a simple majority.
Okay. Additional questions? I see none. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wishes to address House Bill 3501? No one else? Okay, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open the work session. Chair moves House Bill 3501 to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Seeing none, is there any opposition to the motion? House Bill 3501 is moved to the Senate floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Jeff Thompson, Gary, he wasn't here.
Oh, that's... Senator Monroe would like to carry this. You're just bad. Did I close?
No.
We'll close on that one. We will open... Is Barnhart here? He is not here.
Yeah.
Let me write that down.
I'm at 2282.
Well, we'll just go ahead. We'll go down to we'll open public hearing on House Bill 2282. James?
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2282 allows Department of Transportation to receive electronically transmitted documents necessary to do any of the following: issue or transfer a vehicle title, register or transfer a registration of a vehicle, issue a registration plate, or comply with odometer disclosure requirements. Specifies that with exception, acknowledgement by notary public is not required for such transactions. Authorizes the department to adopt rules necessary to carry out provisions of the measure. Specifies that automobile dealers may charge a purchaser of a vehicle for performing any of the following actions: verifying and clearing titles, perfecting, releasing, or satisfying liens or other security interests, complying with federal security requirements, and any other services rendered by the dealer for the purpose of complying with state and federal laws. Limits fees to $150 if dealer uses an integrator, of which $25 is entitled to the integrator, and $115 if the dealer does not use an integrator. No amendments, no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay. I'm going to recess on that just a minute. I see Representative Barnhart moved into the room, so we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2585. James.
Mr. Chair, committee members. House Bill 2585A declares electric vehicle charging station to be personal property of owner of lot in planned community or unit and condominium unless different result is negotiated between parties. Clarifies that if an owner of lot owns charging station, owner must obtain liability insurance policy if charging station is not hardwired into electrical system and is not certified electrical product. Declares emergency effective on passage. No amendment. There are no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Welcome, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Phil Barnhart, State Representative from House District 11. This bill is 2585 is a follow-up of a bill that we passed last time, and I believe that's 13, not 14, in which the legislature, in its great wisdom, and in this case I agree, allowed individual owners to install electric vehicle chargers so long as they complied with the design committee's architectural requests and with a number of provisos. One of the things that that bill did not deal with was the question of who owned this equipment once it was installed. There are many, many different kinds of situations in which electric vehicle charging equipment could be installed. If you're in a planned unit development where everyone has a separate dwelling house, it looks like a town. The idea that the charging unit should belong to the person, the owner of the house that installed it, makes perfectly good sense. That may also be the case in the situation in which a charging unit is installed in a parking spot, which is deeded to the owner of an apartment-style condominium, as is the case of one that my family owns in Portland. We actually have three deeds. One to the apartment itself, one to the parking space, and one to a storage space in the corner. And that's not an unusual arrangement either. A third possibility is a installation in the common parking, where a parking space might be set aside, or several parking spaces might be set aside for electric vehicle charging, but they don't belong to any one person, and they may very well be paid for by one or more of the owners of the in the condominium in order to provide charging for their own cars. There are many other permutations. The point of this was to establish a default position in the statute, and that's all it really does, is establish a default position that unless something else is agreed to, The equipment would belong to the person who paid for it, the owner of the unit. I can easily imagine a situation in which a condominium association decided that they would split the cost or that they would make some other arrangements, and that they would require that the condominium homeowners association own the charging equipment in one of those other examples that I just gave in which parking is not directly related to a particular unit, ownership unit in the condo. That's all this bill really does. It's simply an update on the bill that we passed last time. So far as I know, no one except the drafter of the bill and me is interested in it one way or the other, and I would commend it to your attention.
So you're just clarifying whether the charging stations are personal property or not, essentially.
It's personal property in either case. The question is, is it personal property that belongs to the owner of the condominium who paid for it, or is it personal property of the homeowners association? Right. In this case, what the bill does is say, unless you agree otherwise, it belongs to the owner who paid for it.
Yeah. Okay, Senator.
Sure. Yeah, the question I have is, I'm just reading off the bill summary. I can't find it in the initial language, but it talks about who has to carry liability insurance and not. Would you care to elaborate on that? Because I don't understand why someone puts in a charging station, he has to go buy liability insurance.
Yes, that's a question that I had as well, and I will tell you that we're following the California law in this instance. And I'm trying to find the language here.
I look for it, too.
And as I understand it, if the charging station is hardwired in and complies with the underwriter's laboratory's certification requirements, then this is not needed. If otherwise, still has to be installed by a licensed electrician following all the building code provisions. But in that case, the owner has to carry liability insurance. This does not apply to the homeowners association. It applies to the owner of the unit. To do that, and I know that was in the original bill. I'm not sure why it's being repeated in this one.
I don't see any place except in the language of the existing bill.
That's what I think, too, Mr. Chair. It was adopted last time. It wasn't something that's actually in the change that this bill creates. I can tell you that in Portland, where I have an electric vehicle plug-in, it isn't really a charger. It's just a 240-volt, 50-amp plug-in that I use to charge my electric car. The Homeowners Association, before any of these statutes were in place, wanted to be an added insured on my homeowner's insurance for precisely this reason. Because it is an electrical system that doesn't belong to them and for which they're not responsible. They want somebody else to be responsible for potential fire damage.
Yeah. Other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate hearing the bill.
Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2585A? I don't see anybody else signed up. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2585A. We'll open a work session. Chair moves House Bill 2585A to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion on the motion. Is there any opposition to the motion? Seeing none, House Bill 2585A moves to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. The chair will carry. We'll close on that. We'll reopen on the 2282. And let's see.
Pam is here now.
I have a whole bunch of people here, but I don't have. Did you want? It's your bill. No, it's not. Okay, it's not ODOT's bill. Okay, well then we'll start off with Janet Both. Am I saying that right? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Byer, members of the committee. My name is Janet Borth. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm in the Financial Fraud and Consumer Protection section. This is not a DOJ bill, so I may not be well situated to go over the bill, but I'd like to just highlight a couple concerns the DOJ has with Section 3 of this bill. Section 3 of the bill allows dealers to charge expanded fees to purchasers. In my written testimony, I've gone over some of the recent history of charging fees to consumers. I won't go over that again. But the number of services for which fees can be charged in Section 3 is quite broad. It's verifying and clearing titles, perfecting, releasing, or satisfying liens or other security interests, complying with federal security requirements, and then we have a catch-all. Section 3.2cd, any other services rendered by a vehicle dealer for the purpose of complying with state and federal laws related to the sale of a vehicle. That's broad. It's hard to say. That could be just about anything. So the department has some concerns with the extent to which this bill externalizes just basic costs of doing business. I think most folks would say that complying with the law is a cost of doing business. Generally, consumers aren't expecting to pay for general legal compliance. And one thing we find as a general matter is that the farther along a consumer gets in a transaction, the more committed the consumer is. So the later down the road you find out about what might be a surprise fee, the harder it is to negotiate that fee. It's just a decision-making process. We also have some concerns. We want to make sure that the actual fees being charged by the dealer tie back to actual services rather than creating a windfall. I suppose we don't see a balance of who vets whether a fee is appropriate or not, at least on the face of the bill. Finally, if the committee is inclined to authorize some or all of the fees that are proposed in this bill, DOJ just wants to be sure that that the fee being charged is very clearly on the record as not a fee for the government's cost of regulation. That goes into some tax and finance issues, and we think it's easily solvable.
Questions? No? Okay. Thank you very much. can't quite make it out. The auto D is Greg. It looks like Greg and Mike. All right. Greg, I apologize. I can't quite read your last name there.
My penmanship is not the best, I will say that.
It's probably Dewey's, but, you know.
Thank you, Mike Dewey, Mr. Chair, for the record, representing the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. Greg Remensberger is with me on my right. He's the executive director, president of the association. This bill comes to you, obviously, from the House. It had two no votes. Last Wednesday, I met with DOJ to discuss some issues that they had, and they had an issue about whether or not this was a tax and the externalization of the costs, and I had asked for a memo, and now I have a memo to understand what they're talking about. So this bill has two parts to it, and you will hear another interest in a few minutes. Hopefully in a few minutes, depending on how this goes. We have a very interesting statute that deals with the auto dealers and the opportunity for the for them to help the individual that's buying the car to title and register that car as soon as possible. And that's in the public interest to do that. And what it does say, and this is on page 2, lines 21 and 22, and we're repealing this, that the fee cannot be less than. So I can't find anywhere else in the statute that you have that kind of a fee structure for this kind of work. So what we've done is we've said that the fee is not going to be more than $150, and Greg's going to talk about how the fee works and what an integrator is, and how dealers use integrators, and how we want to have dealers use integrators to process these fees electronically, and all the requirements have come to us since this bill passed in 1999. And looking at the memo, just to say a couple things, there was a discussion about whether or not this fee is a tax based on the Bobo decision. Clearly, at least in our minds, and we could provide something to you if you'd like in a written form, that this is not a tax by any means. It doesn't meet the definition in the Oregon Supreme Court decision. And then we'll have a discussion about externalizing the cost, and this is really a policy for the committee, in my opinion, as to what's the best way to go to ensure that the opportunity for all of these factors come into play, not just including the titling and registration. And we did a survey a couple, 3 years ago as to what it cost just to do the DMV work and what it would cost to do the other entitlements that we have to do. And it is significantly more than we're getting today. So we have a cap on this bill. Greg will talk about exactly what the requirements have been that have come upon us since 1999. And then we have a good car dealer here today from the Dalles that can talk about exactly what they do as they somebody purchases a vehicle. So with that, Mr. Remensberger.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, committee members. For the record, my name is Greg Remensberger. If you can't read my handwriting there, I'm the Executive Vice President of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. I brought Tim Ernest, who is on my board of directors, my vice president of the association, just in case you had some questions in regards to what the services that we as dealers do on behalf of the consumer, so he can address those if you have any questions or if I can't answer those questions in my testimony here. To give you a little bit of background on this fee, the original fee, which is commonly known as a dock fee, was established almost 20 years ago. It was $35, and it was clearly noted in testimony that it was done for services that were provided by the dealership on behalf of DMV. We're working, in essence, as agents of DMV to process the paperwork and get vehicles registered now, which is in the benefit of the law enforcement. It's in benefit of DMV, and it's in benefit of the consumers. So that was never in question. Back in 1999, as Mr. Dewey represented, they changed the bill and took it out of statute, which is where it was controlled at the time, and put it into administrative rule. And at that time, they set the weird part of it, you're not going to charge any less than. And when we've gone back and looked at the testimony, it was done clearly to identify that this is a justifiable fee that can be charged. And therefore, we said we're not going to charge any less than that. Then they empowered the Department of Transportation to set what the cap would be, and DMV was the logical choice for that, and so they set the cap through administrative rule. Over the process, and that happened back in 1999, over the period of years since then, our work as dealers on behalf of the consumer have increased dramatically, and some of the things that Mike referenced, lien perfection that we've addressed in the language of the bill, OFAC, which is our cash reporting rule. If you're buying a vehicle if you're spending over $10,000, you're required to inform the IRS of a cash contribution or sale that was made so that they can, in turn, you have to go through and vet out that this isn't money laundering situation. Identity theft and Privacy Act issues, red flag rule compliance, which is a huge issue for us as dealers, privacy notice, risk-based pricing documentation. And most recently, we were just told that all of the funds that we collect on behalf of DMV now have to be set up in a separate bank account and handled separately from all the rest of our funds because it's state-held funds, and therefore it can't be commingled with the rest of our funds. Well, in our situation where you've got deals that are worked and contingent on getting financing, we in essence enter into a contract right now. But we have a period of time in order for 14 days to finalize and make it a completed deal, funding approved, everything else, because, again, it's always subject to the person's credit rating and so forth. So you roll the vehicle today, and then we process it later on. We've collected the fees as part of that, but then if you can't get the financing and you unwind the deal, now that we've got those funds in a separate account, we've got to take them back out. It's quite cumbersome for us to handle that, and there will be costs involved with that. Back in 2011, we brought all these issues, with the exception of that separate bank account, because that's a current issue. We brought all that to the ODAC group, which is the Oregon Dealer Advisory Council, which has a representative from each of the different licensed entities in the state that can license a vehicle. So it's not only car dealers, new and used, but it's salvage companies, motorhomes, towing companies. If you can get a dealer's license, you have a seat at the ODAC table. So we had presented all of these different things that had come about since the bill was originally instituted, and asked for a price increase for the cap in the administrative rule. We went through, it was approved by everybody, DMV was part of that, everybody approved what it was, and we were pushing that through back in 2011. But when it got to legislative council, they looked at it and said that the statute, again, which said no less than $50, said for the processing of DMV paperwork only. So all these other things that we had in lien perfection and red flag rules and so forth could not be considered into the justification for the fee. So we increased the fee slightly at that point, and we were asked to go back to the legislature and expand that definition of what this fee covered. And that's what this bill is attempting to address, is the expansion of the different services that we provide on behalf of the consumer. So, in essence, we were going about this for several different reasons. One is because of the services that we're now providing, but two, there's also a competitive disadvantage that we have with our surrounding states. This language was not something that we made up ourselves. We were looking at Washington, or California and Idaho. Idaho is not regulated in their dock fee. They can charge whatever they want, and, you know, as long as they charge the same amount to every consumer that comes in. So if I buy a car, I get charged the same fee as Mike, or gets charged the same fee as Tim. In the case of Dave Smith, who's the largest Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge dealer in the world out of Kellogg, Idaho, does a tremendous amount of business. They will fly you into Kellogg, Idaho to buy your vehicle there and say that they sell at $50 over invoice. Well, they charge $600 for a dock fee there, and they're not regulated. And, you know, that is a big enough deal for us to lose business here in Oregon to that. In the case of Washington, they're currently at $150, which is which we're right now at $75 or $100 if you're using the electronic integrator, which is an approved vendor to handle all of the transactions electronically through computer systems with these approved, with the currently one approved vendor. They just went through an RFP and are approving another vendor here shortly, but it will electronically transfer all of this and make it immediate deal. There are costs that the dealers incur in doing that, so they've got a separation of what the fee is if you're doing paper or if you're doing electronically. So in the case of today's business and the car business, it's all shopped online for the most part. Back a number of years ago, as recently as 7 years ago, the average number of dealerships visited before a purchase was 5 dealership visits because you were going around and shopping and comparing. Well, now with the internet being so prevalent and all of the manufacturers putting the price of their vehicles out there for sale on the internet, it's now you shop at home, you do your homework, and you basically walk in to buy your car. The average number of dealership visits before purchase now is 1.4 just this last year. So we've dropped considerably in that, and that's because I'm going to, you know, walk in. I know what my trade-in is worth. I know what you're going to sell me the car for, and you're either going to do the deal or not. And the reason I mention that is, again, getting back to the competitive disadvantage that we have with our surrounding states. $100 is a big enough deal that someone will drive over there and go do it, especially when they're wheeling and dealing. And if you've got somebody on the phone or on your internet and you're going back and forth, it's a matter of rolling a piece of iron today versus not. So there's the list of things that we mentioned that we do on behalf of the consumer. That we took the language, if you look at the language that we have in this and the services that we list as what the fee covers, is exactly the same thing as Washington's language, with the exception of we don't charge a sales tax, which they do. So we're in line with that. Going to the justification for the fee, what we did was we took an NADA workforce study that they had done on the cost of employees, or the, what the benefits packages and salaries and everything that are covered by each position within a dealership. So this is not us sitting down with our dealers. This was a study that was done by the National Auto Dealers Association of all dealers in Oregon on what they pay their title clerks, their general managers, their salespeople, what the owner compensation package is, and everything else that's in there. So we sat down and calculated out how much time it takes for the title clerk to do just the required work of DMV and state and federal regulations to do that, and that came up to $162.38 per transaction. And what we're asking for is $150 if you're using an integrator, of which 25 of that goes to the integrator. So our net cost is less than what it's costing us, so we're not asking for more than what it costs. Separate from that, AAA did a study back in 2011 when we were looking at expanding this language before as well, and their study came out at $156 and change. So it's right in line with the same thing. And again, it was an Oregon-specific bill. So that is the purpose behind what we're trying to do. We're trying to get ourselves compensated for the work we do on behalf of the consumer that has many benefits beyond just what the consumer has, but also keeping us in a competitive disadvantage.
So, Greg, you're saying this is the way, the dock fee is the way that the industry does it?
Yep.
Across the thing. I guess the DOJ point was, if I heard them correctly, they were not discussing or disputing that these are appropriate charges. I think their point was there are legitimate business expenses that should have been included in your price.
Correct. Correct. Of the other states, of the 50 states, 32 states have no cap on the dock fee whatsoever. Of the other states that remain, they average a little bit over $170. So again, we're right in line with what we're doing. Most of them have very similar language to what we have in there. And to address the comment of the broadness of the statement, it says any other state or federal required program. Washington's is even more broad. It just says any other service provided on behalf of the consumer. We put just state and federal requirements. If we're required to do it, and again, because this cap is set in statute, we would have to come back in front of you to justify why we would want an increase if we wanted to. So we think it's pretty well buttoned down.
Okay. Questions? Senator Riley?
Thank you. So tell me if I've got this right. What you want to do is simply increase the dock fee to cover these,
right.
And it's not going to be you got one fee for this, another fee for this, another fee for this. It's going to be one fee that it just raises the price of the dock fee.
Right. And we wanted to, again, because the current statute says for the DMV processing of paperwork only for title and registration, we wanted to expand to include only these other services that we've mentioned in the language.
Mr. Chair and Senator Riley, if I may, and I hadn't thought about this, but I mean, if we're taking a fee that we think actually it was kind of a compromise in our mind that all the numbers 2007, 2011 show more than this. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, we want to be reasonable here. We want to sell the car, obviously. Mm-hmm. And so we thought the number was reasonable. We have this language about the integrator because we want to encourage the dealers to use the integrator to have real-time processing in terms of how the titling and registration goes. I mean, that's in the interest of public safety. And a lot of this came after 9/11, Homeland Security Act and the like, in terms of what we have to do. And then, you know, the idea was it not less than. So the administrative rule was the entity. Now it's not more than 150. So we'll if we need to, we come back and you can look at our numbers and see if it's reasonable.
You know, so in essence, again, Chair Beyer and committee members, the administrative rule will become moot. It will now all be covered by statute and this legislature.
Okay. I'm starting to run short on time, and you're starting to go over the edge of locking yourself out of something here. So be careful.
Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I have
thank you.
Molly and John. I assume just one? Does John want to come up too? I wasn't going to try the last name, John. I apologize, but I couldn't read it.
Mr. Chairman, you wouldn't be the first.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Molly McGrew. I'm here on behalf of my client, John Brueggemann of Motor Vehicle Software Corporation. We are the first part of this two-part piece of legislation in front of you that has to deal primarily with the integrator and vendor who provides the software technology that enables dealers to be able to process these documents electronically. John, did you want to say anything in particular around that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, John Brueggemann with Motor Vehicle Software Corporation, and we are an integrator in the state of Oregon, and part of what we're working on here, the first portion of the bill is to specify that we're able to move documents electronically and allow for electronic signatures. The feds are finally getting out of the way. NHTSA is finally going to start allowing us to use electronic signatures for some of the titling documents. So we see by the end of 2015 going fully paperless, which we're excited about. And we want to make sure the statute was aligned with that change.
Okay. Questions? I'm assuming DMV's cool with this, so
yeah.
They like it. Cuts the work down.
Yep.
Don't see any other questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And let's see. And I have Megan Schrader still out.
I can get her. Hang on. 1 second.
I bet she's going to say she likes the electronic side.
So do I. Let's just...
You want to talk to Pam?
I just
you had it in the record. Yeah. We've seen you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to express the support of the Northwest Credit Union Association. You have my testimony. I didn't have my laptop today, so I could not update it, but we are in support of the Angross version of 2282, and just wanted to let you know electronic signatures is something that our folks have been talking about for the last couple of years. We've talked to DMV, and we are in strong support of moving in that direction. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I don't see Megan, so, well, nope. Maybe I do. No luck.
Nope.
So, anybody else wish to testify on this bill? Close public hearing on House Bill 2282A. Open a work session. Oh, that's right. We're going to hold this one over. That's right. I forgot about that. We'll close the work session, and we're done on that one. We will open on 2803.
Mr. Chair, committee. Oh.
Don't take that as a negative. It's just you've got a wonderful relating clause.
House Bill 2803A provides information that must be included in an order issued by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Approving Beverage Container Redemption Center requires OLCC to provide notice of program requirements to each dealer identified in order as dealer within convenience zones not to be served by or not participating in the redemption center. Requires larger dealers with convenience zone who do not participate in redemption center to meet certain requirements. Requires OLCC to ensure compliance of larger dealers who choose not to participate in redemption center. Specifies that dealer exempt for reason that fewer than 100,000 beverage containers were sold in previous year to report to OLCC number of containers sold. Requires dealer who begins business in either convenience zone after redemption center begins operating to report to OLCC regarding participation in redemption center or, if claiming exemption, to provide estimate of beverage container sales for first calendar year in business and documentation of compliance. Grants OLCC authority to inspect any space occupied by dealer to ensure compliance. Requires OLCC to improve civil penalty of at least $200 for violations per day after providing written notice and 60 days for dealer to curb violation. There are no amendments. There is no revenue impact, and there's a fiscal impact issued.
Amanda Dalton. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, Amanda Dalton here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association to support House Bill 2803 as amended. We've been working on this bill with the OLCC for about the past year and a half. The bill really doesn't make substantive changes to the work that this legislature has done over the last 4 or 5 years around bottle redemption centers and the bottle bill in general. Really what it came down to was we had several retail members not participating in the redemption centers and not complying with the term equivalent services that was adopted in 2011. And we really had, or the OLCC really had no authority to bring them in. They weren't inspecting. And so what this bill does is clarify that they can inspect. The retailer is required to prove up compliance. And we clarified some of the parameters around our applications to OBRC to better identify the retailers that are required to participate and not participate. And I'm glad to answer any questions if you want me to go into more detail.
Based on the one we have in West Eugene and then what I hear in Portland, people like these things.
They've become very popular.
So this bill is really about equivalency, making the playing field balanced for people who are getting into these and people who decide not to.
Chair Beyer, Senator Riley, you're exactly right. What we found is in these convenient zones that we draw to build a redemption center, we've got retailers within that circle that choose not to participate, which is their right under the law. But what we found is they're not complying and taking back as many as they're supposed to take back. So this gives them the option either to join the redemption center or to pay these penalties until they prove that they're in compliance with the law as written.
Into this thing. More? Cool. All right. Any other questions? Senator?
I'm good.
You're good? Thank you very much, Amanda. That's all I have signed up. Does anybody else wish to testify? Don't see any, so are you okay with this bill?
I guess so.
Close public hearing, open a work session. Chair moves House Bill 2803A to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Discussion?
I'd like to say that I sorted one too many bottles in my day, so.
Yeah. I've done that too, Senator. Is there any opposition? There is none. House Bill 2803A goes to the Senate floor with a unanimous do-pass recommendation. All three of us.
Yep. My bottles go to the Boy Scouts anyway, so.
Do you want to carry, or?
Sure, why not?
You got it? Okay, Senator Riley will carry. Sharing around. And with that, I think we're at the end, aren't we? Mm-hmm. Anything else for the good of the order? Seeing none, we're adjourned. We're adjourned.